Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution. At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanti Show.
The foundation for a better life underground with Carrie Patel.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
And our special guest today is Carrie Patel. Hello, Carrie.
Hello, everybody.
So for those that are not familiar with you, because you've never been on this show before, if I recall correctly, in any capacity, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you kind of got into writing.
So The Buried Life is my first novel. Obviously, I write in my spare time, and I'm also a narrative designer for video games. I work full-time for Obsidian Entertainment, which is a game design studio. So it's great to be writing for my day job and getting to write books on my own as well. I guess like a lot of writers, I'd done writing and fiction as a hobby for a long time, and I've certainly been an enthusiastic reader. And so getting The Buried Life published was just sort of a matter of focusing a bit more on that hobby and kind of, learning to smooth out the rough edges and kind of turn a rough story into something more polished and hopefully a lot of fun for readers.
So out of curiosity, since you said you worked for Obsidian Entertainment, are you allowed to say what you have actually worked on there?
I can tell you that I have worked on Pillars of Eternity, which is an upcoming computer RPG. It's actually going to release on March 26th. I can't discuss the specifics of the game itself, but I can tell you a bit about, the process of writing for a game like that.
Oh, that would be great, actually. I'd be very curious and how that connects to writing a novel, which there may be connections that we're not aware of, and you would know because you've done both now.
Sure. So games tell stories in a lot of different ways. There are some that have almost no words in them, and there are some that have quite a lot. And Pillars of Eternity, along with quite a number of Obsidian's RPGs, tend to be a bit more narrative focused and as a result tend to have a lot of characters and a lot of dialogue and, a lot of plot going on in the background. My work oftentimes is about working on the story or the stories, that are going on in the game, that are driving the story forward, that are kind of pushing the player through the action. And that even drills down to something as small as a relatively short quest. So you start with a quest and you say, okay, well, what would make this fun to play through? Like, how do we get the player exploring and fighting and finding new things? But, also what's an interesting story to give the player a reason to do that? And what are some ways to make these quest givers compelling characters rather than just, menu options for your quest? What's a way to give them motives? What's a way to give them colorful personalities? And so then once you've done that, a lot of my job is writing out the actual dialogue that the player sees when they speak to characters in the world, and as they're exploring and learning more about their objectives and just what's going on around them.
Interesting. So it is an interesting thing because an RPG it does a number of things narratively. It has action, it has sort of adventure questing, kind of like discovering stuff, kind of. But when you read this book, The Buried Life, it's a very different kind of work than what you would expect you'd have worked with, because it is, at its heart, it's essentially a murder mystery.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little more complicated, but we don't want to spoil anything. But it basically begins as somebody's murdered, and weird shit's happening, and now we got to figure out what's happening. And so you follow two characters, two groups of characters. Jane, who is a lower class worker who works as a laundress, and then you have Moraine. I've just screwed up her name.
Okay. Malone. Yeah.
Malone. Why did I say Moraine? It doesn't matter. Malone, sorry, like Jenna Malone. There we go. Who is a police officer in this city. So you have these two very interesting viewpoints, both of which are sort of acting as almost like, I guess, like inspectors in terms of kind of uncovering the plot in their own little unique way. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about kind of building their narratives side by side like that and in revealing to the reader different details via different people because of their interactions with the makers of the city, as it were.
Sure. So it was really interesting to get to tell a story from two perspectives. And while I don't think that, you know, the perspectives that Jane and Malone have diverge wildly, they certainly have pretty different relationships with the characters they encounter, and they have kind of different things at stake in terms of solving the mystery. For Malone, this is very much a professional challenge, or at least it starts out that way. You know, this is a case she has to solve as an inspector of the city. And, you know, simply what makes it unusual is the fact that it involves a historian who is, you know, a member of a highly restricted field of study in the world of the buried life. And so kind of all of the bureaucratic roadblocks and sort of the pushback that she gets from, you know, the people running the city, even when some of those people start to fall, become in danger. Those are sort of unique challenges that she has to face as a professional and that start to raise questions for her as to, you know, why exactly these things are happening and what this really means for the city of Recoleta. For Jane, on the other hand, she's a laundress. So as you mentioned, she's a member of the lower class. And a lot of the people who are both under suspicion and who are in danger in this case are her employers. And so she gets involved when she stumbles upon something she shouldn't have seen, and she becomes worried for her own safety. And, you know, to a lesser degree, also worried about her chances of future employment. And so she's more trying to save herself. But, you know, her role in the background of the lives of a lot of these people gives her a unique position, from which to eavesdrop and, you know, get more of an insider's view of what's going on that someone like Malone, who would be very conspicuous as an inspector, that she can't really have. And I think it's always interesting when you look at, you know, kind of, especially a lot of, you know, narratives like, I think, Upstairs, Downstairs and Downton Abbey and, Gosford Park, you know, where you have this, you know, these two sort of narratives running between, you know, the servants and then, you know, the aristocrats that they're serving. And you sort of see how these two interact, but how, you know, the servant class sort of almost exists in the background for these other characters. And yet that gives them, you know, such a rich view as to what's going on in both worlds that, you know, nobody on the other side really has.
Okay, I'll jump in here. I actually want to answer a more fundamental question. So the novel is a mixture of a lot of sorts of genre elements. As we mentioned, it's a murder mystery set in a new weird sort of setting. But I'm going back to the murder mystery for a second. So I was just curious as to your motivation for why run this through a police procedural. Was that you? Basically, where did this come from? Did you start with the world and decide to graft this sort of narrative structure on it so we could see it through Malone and Jenna's eyes, or whether or not that came first? I'm just curious why a police procedural, and what advantages do you think that would have over other narrative structures in exploring the world of Recoleta?
Sure. So I guess I really started with the world itself, you know, the idea of this underground city, and I had a particular flavor and atmosphere in mind. And kind of from there, I started thinking about what kinds of characters would be there and what kinds of characters I would want to tell a story about. And, you know, that's kind of when I started getting the ideas for Jane and Malone and for, you know, several of the other secondary characters. And then from there, I thought, well, what kinds of mischief would they get into together? What kind of story would bring them all together in an interesting way. And I guess, I don't know, I feel like there's certainly something to the atmosphere of a murder mystery. I think those tend to be a lot of fun. They certainly introduce stakes early on. And they give the reader a good reason to explore the city through the characters who are solving that mystery. There was actually something that David Brin has said before about how, you know, mystery structures are actually great for speculative fiction writers because they force you to kind of, you know, follow a plot, drop clues, you know, give readers something to explore and kind of keep you from just, you know, going off the deep end in kind of world building with no context. Mm-hmm. And so I think a murder mystery definitely gave me the opportunity to define Recoleta in a plot relevant way, to kind of unfold it gradually for the reader. And hopefully to set up some very interesting questions, both about the world and also just about, you know, who's killing these people and why is that happening?
So the world building is actually another thing I want to talk about, because one of the particular weird bits of this is that there is a great deal of censorship in this particular city, particularly with history and what is allowed to be shared publicly. And that does involve the plot to some degree. Maybe we don't want to reveal how. But I was curious what, you know, is designing this world with this sort of a kind of top-down censorship involved, because it's essentially the not necessarily directly, but the aristocracy has control over the knowledge to some degree of what gets sort of put into the public libraries. So I'm curious, what's the question I'm looking? The question I'm looking for is totally just fell out of my brain. Help me, Paul.
So you're asking about censorship and the control of information within the city?
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of what I wanted to sort of explore with a little bit, yeah. It's not a question. That's the problem.
It's a topic.
It's a topic.
It's a topic.
We can go with that.
Have at it.
All right. I think the idea of censorship always, you know, as a writer, as anyone who's trying to set up a story, certainly gives you a lot of rich avenues to explore. You know, that's a big world mystery in and of itself. And it certainly gives you a lot of obstacles and challenges to throw up around your characters. And I think also as a reader and a writer, the idea is a very dangerous thing, and that you would have a society that recognizes that or that perceives that in a very, very extreme sense is pretty interesting. You know, people say things like, oh, knowledge is dangerous, and, you know, they become kind of interesting catchphrases. And, I guess I thought it would be interesting to see, well, what would happen if you really did have a group of people who thought that something so bad happened in the past that simply knowing what it was would be infectious. You know, that information is almost a virus, and that, you know, the safest way to protect yourself from the mistakes of the past is not necessarily to know what they were, because then you're just going to commit those same errors yourself, but mm-hmm. to try to distance yourself from it. And so that was sort of that's the philosophy of the ruling class of Recoleta. And it's a philosophy that, you know, most of the people in the city are very sympathetic with.
That's really interesting. I'm curious. Okay, so that's almost like it's a slightly spoiler, I'll say, almost like the founding principle of Recoleta in many ways is to control the past, control information, control society. I was curious about the strong bureaucratic structure of the world, which seems to be fractally created as you go down levels. I mean, you have the ruling class, and then you have the departments and the departments below them, and it's very much just like ever expanding trees. And I was curious as to why you chose that structure rather than say a more autocratic approach or some other forms of, for lack of a better word, despotism. Because this is a very despotic society, but in a very bureaucratic way.
I guess it seemed to me that there's something, you know, almost a little bit more benign about saying, well, no, you know, this isn't this autocratic leader. This is just, you know, our system of departments. And, you know, it's not that actually makes life better or makes, you know, the society more navigable to the people living in it. But I think it certainly takes away a little bit of that initial sting of, oh, wow, these people are merciless. They rule with an iron fist. And you know, when you say, well, no, it's not that. It's just, this is our system and this is the way things work and these are our checks and balances. And I think it seems like there are a lot of interesting power structures you can hide behind a complex bureaucracy. And so, you know, to avoid kind of that, I don't know, I didn't want to go so far as like Brazil, for instance, but, you know, to hide kind of that initial sense of, oh, you know, these are the rulers and this is the terrible dystopian society, you know, that oppresses everyone, wanted to kind of hide that behind. Well, no, this is just the system everybody lives under, which means everything's fairly regimented, you know, but in what almost seems to be a mundane fashion, at least for the people living in it.
Almost banal in some ways. It's like, we're doing this for your own good, to protect you, the citizens, and you, the public.
Right. And yeah, and like the person who's standing in your way usually isn't an armed guard. It's, you know, some elderly bureaucrat with lots and lots of paperwork. And I think that feels very different.
Yeah, it gives a different impression than the kind of overt, I guess, despotism or fascism that we would think of, the violent form.
Right.
Where it's easier to say that is just pure evil. We can, you know, we can discard it in that sense. But this is much more complicated, mm-hmm. because it's not – your instinct might be to read it as evil, but at the same time it's like, but it's not really.
Right.
It's really complicated and – also, it kind of makes you think about your own world and how mm-hmm. it's kind of bureaucratically yeah. designed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I haven't read it yet. Just a comment. I'm amused by the parallels between your book and your sister book that came out on the same day from Angry Robot, Flex, by Ferret Steinmetz, who the main character is a magician who uses bureaucracy as his source of sorcery. So. Mm-hmm. You both are exploring bureaucracies in completely different ways, which I find an interesting coincidence.
Oh yeah, I haven't picked up Flex yet, but I've definitely been interested in it, and I've certainly seen Ferret, you know, talking on a lot of the blogs about it. And it looks like a fascinating book, so I'm excited to know that he's got some bureaucracy going there too.
We should actually talk a little bit about the bureaucracies here, because it does, of course, have a really big impact on the development of the plot, because Malone, working for the central sort of the police, the municipal police, as they're called, you know, they have a sort of a specific relationship with the sort of aristocracy, the counselors who sort of run the city. And that, of course, causes issues, because it means when she's investigating things that should be her purview, oftentimes that creates walls because the other side doesn't necessarily want to work with the municipal police. And that does happen here, right? Is there's a point at which they step in and say, we're going to take care of these murders among our own kind, and we're going to basically establish martial law and put police everywhere, but there'll be city guard. Instead of police, which I think is interesting, because talking about the bureaucratic element, the way in which it, on the one hand, appears benign, I mean, maybe deceptively so, at the same time has sort of this underlying current of oppression that's built into it.
Yeah, well, and I wanted to set up the municipal police, which is Malone's organization, as, you know, separate from the council and separate from the city guard, which operates directly under the council. You know, and I thought that for a character like Malone, you know, the idea that the municipal police exists as sort of this, I mean, everyone reports to the council to a degree, but the municipal police are not like the other directorates. They're not like the rest of the bureaucracy, and that they're functionally independent. And so for her, seeing that independence taken away when the council says, no, really, we're going to look into this and it's for your own good, is a big blow to her, and something that seems fundamentally wrong to her, because that's just not how those systems are supposed to work. So, I mean, she's sort of a creature of the bureaucracy in her own way, even though she doesn't have a lot of patience for, you know, kind of the foot dragging and the red tape that she sometimes has to deal with. I think she does, at least at the beginning, understand that there's a sort of, that there's some, you know, a method to the madness, and that there's, you know, a reason that these power structures are set up the way they are, and that the municipal police has a specific role within them. And so seeing, you know, her role demolished in that way, I think really spurs her on to look a lot deeper into the mysteries around her.
Actually, I think it's interesting that you brought up her somewhat lack of patience, because it's one of the interesting things about her characters. She eventually gets, of course, you know, to some degree we have to expect it, that she's going to get the new recruit. It's going to be her yeah. guy, right, that's going to work with her. But of course, we'll talk about him in a minute, because he's actually really good. He's not just a new recruit. He's quirky, but in a very interesting way. But she begins this narrative being kind of that I almost want to kind of say like the Dirty Harry type, the kind of like, I'm in this system and I just got to do this job, but like, I'm not going to take anybody's crap mm-hmm. as I'm doing it, which maybe doesn't always work in her favor, but it is part of her character. And I was curious what you were, when you were developing her character and making her into this sort of more grizzled, police officer. I mean, where did you draw the inspiration for that? Or if that question is maybe not relevant, sort of talking about the creation of her as you sort of built the world and built her into it, because it seems like the world and her sort of had to come together as one in a way.
Yeah, I think for me, the idea of kind of like, you know, the inspector with the long black trench coat who doesn't take anybody's guff, who, you know, kicks down doors and always knows what she's doing. It definitely seemed like something that just felt right for the city of Recoleta and for the atmosphere I was trying to create, and just, you know, the flavor of the world and of the story. And at the same time, she's somebody who has to go up against a lot of very powerful forces. You know, she needed to be someone who was, you know, bullheaded enough to be willing to do that. Mm-hmm. And to be willing to do that simply because she felt it was the necessary thing to do, and, you know, which makes kind of some of these more dramatic elements of her personality, I think, you know, make a lot of sense. But I also wanted to look at that character type as maybe someone who's also really missing something. And I think her relationship with her rookie partner brings a lot of that out. Yes, she's very driven and dedicated and she knows what she's doing. But there's also a bit of a sense of emptiness about her. And I think as she explores what's sort of missing in this story about her city, I think she also has to kind of confront what's missing for her personally, and, you know, what those empty places are for her.
So let's take Paul, do you have questions? Oh, you did. You put a hand up. Okay, so Paul, yep. You can go ahead and jump in. Sorry, I was going to jump to the partner, but
No, I want to explore. It's actually going to be a bridge into the partner with my question.
Oh, perfect.
Okay, so one of the, I know this is 2015. We shouldn't be asking these sorts of questions and just say because you wanted to. But why did you make Malone a female character? I mean, the archetype, as we've talked about, of the grizzled veteran is a very strong male sort of archetype, Sean put it, the Dirty Harry type. So you kind of gender flip that by making her female, and you make the partner male, which sometimes would be a young female instead, but you flip that on its head. I was just curious as to your motivation, and how different do you think it would be versus the standard configuration for this sort of mystery?
No, it's hard to say if it really would have been that different, you know, in terms of plot or in terms of character development if she'd been a male. And you're definitely right that character archetype seems to, you know, figure a lot. It seems to encompass male characters a lot more than female characters. And I guess, I don't know. I think when I just started thinking about the character, I just thought, well, Malone's a woman. And I think that's just part of who she is. And it's not that for me her characterization or the role she plays in the story needed to change because of that. It just felt like the right choice for her. Like, also the fact that, you know, she has eyes that are this color and hair that's that color. It just seemed like part of the character. And, you know, there's something, I guess, in terms of determining a character's gender, there's something pretty interesting that I read from Max Gladstone a couple years ago, because I know he also writes a lot of, you know, very diverse characters, and he, you know, kind of avoids the typical, well, this is the male character's role, this is the female character's role sort of tropes. Sure. You know, and one thing he said was that, you know, when I'm working on a character, I think about what my first impulse is, and half the time I switch it. And I thought that was a great approach. Not because you have to aspire to some particular quota with your characters, but simply because, you know, I think if you're always doing the thing that seems immediately obvious, I think you're more likely to find yourself, you know, reproducing someone else's work or someone else's tropes. And I think something even as, you know, simple and personal as, you know, changing a character's gender, can kind of force you to avoid the full trope and create something that's a more interesting and a more unique riff on, you know, again, the idea of the grizzled investigator, or whatever you're working with.
Sure. I could see how Inspector Malone is kind of like Madame Kavarian in that way. Madame Kavarian, the older, teacher and investigator in Max Gladstone's world. And that's like, again, a character trope you normally would associate with a male, but both you and he gender flipped that dynamic and bring something new and fresh to the role, and therefore can do more interesting things with the side character, which I think Sean wanted to talk about now.
Yeah,
Sundar.
Sundar. I like him because he's kind of a dork, and it's kind of adorable. So, but I did want to say, Paul, that when you were talking about how, that this type of character is typically coded as male, immediately what came to my mind was the new Dredd movie.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which has Dredd, who's hyper-masculine, played brilliantly by Carl Urban, whose mouth is always a grimace, in a way that Clint Eastwood could never manage, by the way. Just, I don't know how he did it. He must have had, like, Botox or something to get that mouth just perfect. But then, of course, his partner is kind of the opposite. She's not a particularly good police officer. She just happens to have one quirky ability that makes her particularly useful for the police. But she's not a very aggressive person. She's sort of what you would think of as a sort of a total foil to Dredd, who's just like, he just waltzes in. He says, "Get on the ground or I'll shoot you in the face." And she's kind of like, "Well, you can get on the ground and then I'll ask you again in a minute. But I'm going to read your mind, and it's going to be creepy." There was some creepy stuff in my mind reading. But anyway, I'm sorry. But that was immediately what I went to my mind, because I really love that movie.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that with gender tropes, because she is a very empathetic character, and that's part of what sets her apart from Dredd, is he sees things as very black and white, and she says, well, no, this person is in this situation because of a specific set of factors. You know, this isn't necessarily a bad person. And I feel like that is, you know, a very much sort of a trope of, you know, the female character, or the female foil, is she's more understanding, she's more empathetic. And I thought they certainly tied that in really well with, with her, you know, mental abilities. But I thought that maybe one character that definitely played against type a bit more was Lena Headey's villain.
Yes.
I thought that was an amazing and terrifying character. And I thought they did something pretty amazing, you know, in that they cast a really beautiful woman to play this character who in my mind at least, was not sexualized at all. Like, she's just scary, you know?
She's terrifying.
She is terrifying. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you're right that I didn't think of her as being sexualized. I think because of how she is created. I mean, how she becomes the mastermind of crime that she becomes,
right,
is actually the rejection of that. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I was just saying, she's not a femme fatale, but she's also not this hyper-masculine woman. I didn't read her as, you know, hewing to any particular gender tropes or, you know, typical gender identities.
Right, because we would have certain expectations of what she might fulfill. And I think you're right I'd have to watch it again, but I think you're right that she doesn't. And that probably is what makes her much more lethal, because it's harder to know what to expect with her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, gosh, I think that first moment when she kills the people, those random criminals who fail her or whatever, and she gives them the slow-mo and, like, throws them over the balcony.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to feel euphoria and watch themselves die really slowly, because it slows their perceptions down.
Yeah.
It's really ruthless. It's really actually even more cruel than just throwing them off the balcony.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I'm going to throw you off, but now you're also going to have to feel it for like a month as you fall.
Right.
That's actually really evil. That movie's so good. So I'm sorry. We should jump back to the book. So Paul was right. I did want to talk about Sundar because Sundar is not originally a police officer. Would you care to illuminate for those that have not read the book yet? What was he originally?
He was originally an actor, and an improv actor specifically.
Which I love because, you know, it wasn't one of those things where it was like, oh, it's just that weird, quirky, like his past has just got a weird, quirky thing in his past. You actually bring it into the novel in a very unique way, which he uses that skill of acting and improvising in order to kind of lure people into giving him information that Malone maybe couldn't get because she's just less patient with that kind of thing. And I really wanted to talk about sort of developing this this foil for Malone. I mean, I feel like he is kind of a foil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely wanted to set up someone who had, you know, very different skills and a very different personality from Malone. You know, and part of that is, you know, from her perspective, and you've already gotten to know her a little bit by the time he's introduced, you kind of pick and you do see her as this, you know, very solitary person who tends to be, you know, very direct. She's very blunt. You know, it's not that she has no sense of subtlety. It's just if there's a more direct way to get something, she would prefer that almost all the time. And so, you know, I thought, well, you know, what's something that would kind of throw a wrench in her gears? Well, if she had to work with someone and work with someone new, and, you know, if all those things she didn't like to do, you know, like talk to people and, you know, kind of use a bit of soft power and kind of, you know, finesse answers out of people. If that's something he really, really liked to do. And in her experience, that doesn't work. But maybe he's actually really good at it. And I also, you know, so I had this relationship between the two of them, you know, and something that I hoped would also open both of them up to really appreciate the other one a bit more in time. But I thought, well, what's the one other thing, you know, this guy's a rookie. What's the one other thing that would just really make Malone roll her eyes at him and think, you've got to be kidding me, anybody but him. And I thought, well, what did he do before he became a police inspector? Oh, well, he was an actor. She would hate that. You know, she would see that as totally useless and uninteresting. And what the heck are you doing here, guy? But yet, like you said, it does actually figure into his rather unique skill set. And it becomes pretty useful for both of them.
I love the scene where they go to, oh gosh, is it the Directorate of Preservation?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Is the one where they go to. And she's just kind of like, all right, you do your thing, dude. And mm-hmm. And he puts on the glasses and he just does this whole bit. And she's sitting there going like, how is this secretary falling for this? Like, this is so obviously overacting, but right. he's just does it. He just like really works it. And I love that she's always kind of surprised mm-hmm. by how good he actually is at getting the information that they need by doing these kinds of really clever manipulations.
Mm-hmm.
I just love that scene.
Oh, thank you.
He's dropping his glass. He's like, oh, heavens me, I dropped my lens. Please, will you retrieve it for me? I don't know. That's not the dialogue. I'm just sorry. In my head, Sundar sounded very suspiciously like Jarvis from mm-hmm. Iron Man.
Yes. Yeah. I think he's definitely a bit, comes across as a bit more genteel maybe than Malone. And I think that would definitely be his act with that particular woman.
It's so funny. I love that scene. Sorry. That's just a good scene.
Thank you. I'm glad you liked it. I had a lot of fun writing it.
It must have been. I imagine writing these two characters because, you know, that there are sort of foils for one another. And so writing these two characters kind of not quite going head to head, but, you know, two drastically different procedural styles, you know, but them both of them having to kind of discover when to use one over the other, because of course Malone very quickly realizes that he is a rookie, he's like a new kid, but he's not useless. He's actually quite useful.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciated that that's where you went early on, that you didn't have it be sort of like at the end she'll appreciate him, she starts to appreciate him really quickly because she realizes what he can provide. Because then it kind of gets into the dynamic between them. We get to see more of that instead of the kind of the conflict.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think with a lot of characters, I always think it livens up a scene and it livens up kind of any dynamic when you can have two people who, even when they're working together, they kind of push each other's buttons just a little bit. And I think because, you know, Malone and Sundar really are both very skilled and very competent. And I think as, you know, as the reader, you hopefully get to appreciate, you know, both of them pretty early on. And so, you know, I didn't want to spend too much time making one or the other one of them out to be especially unreasonable by just, you know, putting their foot down and saying, no, despite seeing otherwise, I just won't accept this person. But I think, yeah, they're differing personalities. They're differing approaches. That was also something that I really liked bringing in, for instance, with Jane and Frederick, who were, you know, good friends and confidants. But, you know, she's pretty practical and pretty quiet, and he's very foppish and very irreverent. And so, you know, even with character pairs like that, where they're allies, they cooperate together, I think it's, you know, interesting when you can show these two people who have a certain amount of trust between them, but they still kind of have this subtle conflict and this subtle set of differences that they're always working out between one another.
It's true. That's true. I think it's interesting you brought up Frederick, because we haven't talked about him yet. And he was another one of those interesting characters. There's a number of interesting characters, but the two ones that I want to talk about are Frederick and Mr. Arnold.
Uh-huh.
I may be saying wrong, but that's...
Roman Arnold. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll take Frederick, and I'm guessing, Paul, you can talk about Mr. Arnold.
Sure.
Okay. Awesome. So Frederick, as you mentioned, right, he has this very unique dynamic with Jane. We learn in the novel that he sort of sponsored to bring her, basically to bring her into the city out of an orphanage and to help her sort of get on her feet, which, sort of really humanizes him, because he starts the novel, I think, being kind of not quite sleazy, but being like almost like the paparazzi of this world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of, he's out there to get the story because he's a journalist, and that's kind of his story. But it really humanizes him. But what I found interesting about Frederick too is that he, throughout the novel, becomes this interesting mediating character between the worlds, because he does actually get involved in the aristocracy in a way that Jane initially doesn't. She does sort of, kind of, a little bit. But I found him really interesting in that respect, because he becomes that. Like that figure that kind of lies right between, mm-hmm. and kind of go into both worlds. And I don't know if that's the kind of the intent you had with his character, building him in that way. But if, you know, if you could talk about a little bit of kind of designing him and putting him in the world in such a way so that he was in the middle there. Yeah.
Sure. You know, I think one common criticism I've heard of, you know, protagonists in, you know, a lot of novels, and I guess genre novels in particular, is that it seems like many of them oftentimes don't really have a personal life outside of the plot relevant stuff. Like, you know, you don't see these people interacting with their friends and their families, you know, in just sort of a normal day to day, this is my world sort of sense. And so for Jane, I really wanted Frederick to be someone who is, you know, kind of that personal life for her, and, you know, kind of part of her day to day, but also someone who, you know, as a journalist, with some unique connections, does give her an opportunity, both to learn about aspects of this, you know, the aristocracy and this kind of more dangerous world that she's getting drawn into, and someone who could also provide, you know, a couple of useful connections for both Jane and Malone. And I think for him, kind of finding that balance between being, you know, a fairly outrageous character and someone who at times can be a little bit of a jerk. I mean, you do get the sense that, you know, yeah, when he walks into her apartment the first time he's introduced and he's talking about this murder, he doesn't really care about the person who was murdered. This is a story to him. And it sounds very callous, but I don't think it's necessarily an unrealistic approach for someone in his position. I mean, that is his work. That's his job. And, you know, he is pretty opportunistic, but, you know, I think through his relationship with Jane, as you said, you do also see someone who's very humane and who's very giving with the people that he's close to. And I guess, you know, I was, like to shy away from trying to make someone seem, you know, too nice just because we couldn't imagine them doing or saying those things that probably most people would. But if you can, I prefer to kind of humanize them through other details rather than through just, you know, sanitizing their interactions with everybody else.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair way of kind of approaching that. Yeah. I think it works with Frederick particularly. Because as you say, right, I mean, he that moment when he's talking about the murder and he just is like, yeah, I don't really care about who got killed. Like, that's not the interesting part.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's even a point in the novel where he's like, yeah, I know some other guy got killed, but that's not actually interesting. Or maybe, yeah, but I think that there's that moment where you think it's callousness, but it's not necessarily. It's more like, you know, he's in this world, he is a journalist, and this is actually literally his job. I mean, he knows what actually sells papers because
right.
It's his job to do so. I mean, it's sort of like, it's not callous for one to not talk about stuff that isn't going to sell paper, I guess. But it comes off that way because if you just think about those lines, you know, outside of the context of the rest of his character, it does come off in a very kind of unempathetic way. But in fact, he does care about people, which is something that you do a good job of showing. So,
yep. Especially to Jane.
Right.
Yeah. Very much so with her. Yeah. I mean, his relationship with her, more so than his relationship with basically anybody else. I mean, it's a very strong relationship. I mean, he's very loyal to her, but yeah, I'm kind of rambling. So
Yeah. Maybe
Paul would like to take us to my other favorite character.
Well, I just want to make a comment that although they're not romantic relationships, the way I thought of them in my mind is alpha couple is Malone and Sundar, beta couple is Jane and Frederick.
Mm-hmm.
And they orbit around each other. They have interactions between the two couples, but basically those are the two poles you have of the major characters in the novel and how they wrap around each other in not quite a romance sort of structure, but sort of like the two lightning rods around
mm-hmm.
things. And one of the things that are between both sets is Mr. Roman Arnault. I found him interesting mainly because he's the first character we really get to see Jane's perspective and then Malone's perspective, and they're completely different. And he's almost, how can I put this properly? I mean, given his weird relationship with the council and with the whole structure, he's almost like in a three-dimensional sphere intruding upon this two-dimensional reality. And he's fascinating as he shrinks and changes and interacts with everybody in completely different ways. He's like a wild card. I wanted you to talk about how you developed him and especially the writing and how you decided to keep showing different facets of him to different characters as he interacts with them.
Yeah, I think I definitely wanted him to be someone that, you know, you would keep guessing about his motives and his real strategy up until the end. You know, and like you said, he meets both Malone and Jane, but he has very different relationships with both of them, and they come away with very different impressions of him. And I think for me, that fit my idea of him as, you know, a character who's very shrewd, but, you know, is always careful not to really show too much of himself to anybody. And, you know, it's kind of unclear for a while whether he's, you know, a decent guy who does dirty work or whether he's a nasty guy who's, you know, good at smiling and shaking hands.
Mm-hmm.
Or whether he's something in between. And, you know, I don't want to give anything away on that front for sure, but I think it made sense too that he would meet Jane and Malone in very different contexts. And, you know, Malone's the inspector. And so she looks at him and she sees somebody who hides things and someone who hides things for other people and is immediately suspicious. And, you know, he's keen to that. Like he recognizes that. And, you know, he doesn't appreciate her intrusions any more than, you know, she appreciates his secrecy. And with Jane, on the other hand, you know, I think they're both very curious about one another. He's very perceptive. And I think, you know, even though he's a part of the aristocracy, and even though he does a lot of work for his peers in the aristocracy, he's a bit of an iconoclast and he doesn't really cleave to the traditions and the status symbols the way a lot of other characters kind of in his, you know, in his strata do. And so I think that that gave him sort of an interesting way to relate to somebody like Jane, who normally somebody, you know, somebody in his sphere would never talk to somebody in hers. But the fact that he does, I think, makes him interesting to Jane, and hopefully interesting to the reader as well. And, you know, again, goes back to, well, you know, what's this guy really up to and what's he really like? And is this part of him being decent or is this part of him being devious?
Right. I mean, I'm not going to say in the old sense, he's a romantic character in a sense of romance, in the sense of not as in love romance, but as in romance, as in that sort of almost Dumas sort of quality to him. He's a dashing figure. I mean, he dances with Malone, which I didn't expect. Like, wait, Malone dances? What the hell is that? And then he has this almost like this entree to Jane into a greater world. So yeah, he bridges that. He does what he wants. Yeah. Yeah, Dumas, I think you agree with me, Sean, that Dumas is a really good parallel for Roman's character as far as literary tropes and bridges. What do you think, Sean?
Yeah, I think that's fair, yeah.
So let's go from that to a more of setting base, since we've talked about all of the main characters. There are some other characters who we shouldn't reveal because they'd be very spoily. So the novel comes off, it's an underground city, and the reasons why it's underground are, again, kind of spoilery, but so why, it has a really new, weird sort of feel to have a buried city and people living underground. I mean, there's stuff above ground. I mean, we saw that right from the get-go when we see Malone on the run, but people seem to have settle into this new life underground. So I was curious as to what you've read in the New Weird, what you've taken from that, and how you've applied those ideas for your own setting.
I guess a lot of my favorites in New Weird, you know, I love China Mayville. You know, obviously Robert Jackson Bennett, City of Stairs is fantastic, although
yes,
you know, that one recently came out. I think what sets a lot of the great settings in New Weird apart is simply that they don't seem to be following a really specific pattern. You know, they take bits and pieces maybe from a lot of other ideas or settings, but they definitely kind of meld them together into something that's very unique and something that really fits that story and those characters and, you know, that setting specifically. And as far as, you know, setting it underground, it was something that just seemed very aesthetically interesting to me. And, you know, since this is also a novel about mysteries and murder and, you know, secrets and forbidden history, you know, having this all set in an underground city seemed to be sort of thematically appealing as well. But I know that there are a number of works of fiction, like the Wool series, by Hugh Howey that, you know, do the underground setting, but, you know, the underground setting there is really more of a matter of necessity. And so, very early on, I thought, well, you know, yes, everybody's living underground. And no, it's not like they can't go above ground, but, you know, I think that sort of the force of habit and of cultural expectation, can be just as powerful as anything else. And so I kind of wanted to play with the idea that, well, people live in this way, not because they have to, you know, but maybe because they got acclimated to it for other reasons. You know, by this point, it's really just something that's stuck for them. And so, you know, going above ground isn't necessarily dangerous, but it's just not the done thing. And that could be just as defining for a setting, I think, as, you know, a more present danger, you know, like a dangerous surface or something, or environmental problems.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me a little bit, I don't know if Sean's ever read it or you have, it kind of remind me of some of the settings in Isaac Asimov's later galactic novels, like Caves of Steel, for example.
Hmm.
Are you familiar with?
I've only read Nemesis. That's the only Asimov I've
okay.
read yet.
Okay. I thought maybe you were doing a bit of an homage to Caves of Steel. For those listeners who haven't read it, Caves of Steel is set in Isaac Asimov's future history. Most of the cities and interactions are underground, and people have agoraphobia about going above ground. It's not like they can't. There's nothing wrong with the surface. It's just that that's where things are. And Caves of Steel is that in that the heart of it is actually a murder mystery itself too.
Huh.
Yeah, with the human and with a robot together trying to solve crime and I thought, well, maybe this is a Caves of Steel homage, maybe not. I don't know. But yeah, it definitely has the parallels. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it being above ground, but sensible people just don't do that. You live mm-hmm. you live in your city underground, and that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Help me out here, Sean. I'm on a limb.
I think that something that you were sort of implying earlier about the way in which the city works in the novel is it also applies to the sort of social structure to some degree in the novel because of who walks where and when it would be appropriate. I mean, not just specifically the city's design as being an underground city and who walks above the surface and who walks below, but even to some extent, I think there's a moment early in the book, so I'm not really spoiling anything, when two people who are of the council are having a conversation, but they intentionally go into the sort of the merchant area where they would not normally go because they know that they will be ignored while they're there because of their status. So there's this interesting way in which you use the city as a way of kind of delineating boundaries mm-hmm. of where people can go and where they're expected to go rather than where they can go necessarily. It seems to me that was a very conscious effort in sort of building the city and building its social structure.
Yes.
Of course it was. but I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that actually. So we've talked a little bit about the aristocracy versus kind of showing the class differentiation, but the way in which you kind of put it together with the way in which the city's structured.
Sure. So in the city, the upper class, the aristocrats, they're referred to as white males. And the origin of that term is that when people first moved underground, when these, cities, which maybe began as very large bunkers, were first inhabited, the people you trusted, the people who did useful things, the people who you didn't give the grunt labor to would have been, a variety of people from, doctors and engineers to construction foremen. Who would have been very good at saying, at directing activity, basically, or performing some of the necessary functions. And everybody else would be getting their hands dirty. And so these people who weren't getting their hands dirty had clean fingernails, and they're called the white nails now. And they sort of flaunt that by, in that most characters in that, in the white nail class, grow very long fingernails just to sort of show off, yes, this is who we are, and this is what our status is, even though, the origin of that, is very different from what the class has, evolved into. And the districts in Recollet, I think, are very much set up with an idea that, this is where certain people go. There's the factory districts, which, kind of like factory settings in kind of any Victorian novel or show or setting, they tend to be very dirty. They tend to be very crowded. The air is very uncomfortable to breathe, and there are a lot of people. The work there is hard, and it's not really the kind of place that anybody wants to end up. And so that's traditionally, a lower class area of town. Jane lives just on the edge of, she lives just outside of it. And so it's something that's always present in her mind that she's escaped that kind of life. But she's still very precariously balanced next to it. And then you have characters like Roman Arnault and the rest of the white nails who inhabit this place called the Vineyard, which is, the very lovely, opulent residential area, which is very near, but separate from the bureau districts, which are, where all the directorates, like the Directorate of Preservation and the Directorate of Excavation and all of these other very functional parts of the city are located, and that it's, it's convenient because it's close by, and there's a definite connection there between, the people who live in the Vineyard are oftentimes the ones who run those directorates. But there's also something to, about appearances and how they separate them, their status and their wealth from, that rather unseemly and, work that takes place behind closed doors. And then you have places like the market, which you mentioned, which, that's one of those places where everybody comes together. And so for two counselors to make the decision to have a rather private conversation there, it's sort of about losing themselves in the crowd. And it's also about sort of taking advantage of people's unconscious deference towards them and their sort of tendency to give them space, you know, whereas if they tried to have a meeting like that, like the one that they were having in their part of town, it would most likely be observed and questions would be asked, and it would be harder to know that they were really getting the kind of privacy they wanted.
Paul?
Yeah, so I'm going to tread very carefully to avoid spoiling, but that does tie into another strand of this novel. Yes, it's a new weird novel. It's a police procedural, and it's also in some ways a political, I don't know, thrill is quite the word, a political...
You just call it a political thriller. Yeah.
A political thriller in some ways. And you tease that up very slowly. I mean, there's something at the beginning, and then you tease that up very slowly. So I'm curious as the origins of this strand, because you do make some very pointed points about politics, about class and structure. I was curious as to how and why you layered that into this novel as well, especially since it's almost a reveal to really draw back and we see what really is going on.
Yeah.
Sure. So, you know, one of the fun things about being a speculative fiction writer and getting to, you know, make up this weird setting where, you know, things are a certain way and, you know, people are divided into these classes and, you know, it's interesting to look at as a set piece and it's interesting to write in, you know, as a setting because it sets up all of these obstacles and challenges and plots and mysteries for the characters and the readers to navigate. But I feel too, like when you do that, it's almost a shame not to really explore, that setting as an integral part of the plot in and of itself. You know, you're saying this strange world exists for these reasons, and this is the way it affects characters. And this is something very, you know, these murders are something very big that's happening in the midst of this city, and it's transforming it in certain ways. And I feel like it's, you know, it almost would have been a shame not to follow that up. And, you know, take it all the way to the end of the book and say, and here's what this really means for the city. And, you know, here's where things are really going. I feel like it always had to be about something bigger than the murders and, you know, bigger than the individual characters who are exploring them. And, you know, as you said, kind of the political elements and, you know, the question of how this world functions and does it function well are there from the beginning. And I think kind of opening those things up more in later parts of the book, that was important to me. And part of why, you know, in my mind, like you said, this is a political thriller as much as it is a murder mystery.
Yeah, yeah. We're getting close to about an hour. So that, unless Paul has last questions that he desperately wants to get out. Yes, that's a yes.
Yes, yes. So that's a yes. Sean knows me well. So we haven't talked about the meta aspects of this, but I'll go for it. Maybe you're tired of talking about them at this point, but the novel, thanks to Trouble Wet, as publishers, had a long and tortured road to publication, and you must be relieved that it's actually finally out. So it's curious though, given that road, what, how has the novel changed, or have you had to do any major revision between when it was first announced and when now it's final form?
You know, I actually didn't have to do a lot of revision for Angry Robot. You know, working on The Buried Life, it took several years, and they weren't years of working, you know, full-time focusing on this novel by any means. I think it was just one of those things where kind of the process of learning how to tell this story well, learning how to polish some of my rough edges as a writer, you know, and how to bring out the characters, you know, in the best way possible took a bit of time. And so, you know, by the end of that, what I submitted to Angry Robot is almost exactly what they published. You know, there weren't really any major structural edits. And the, you know, there were some line edits and a few, you know, points that needed to be clarified, but most of it was already there. And I was both surprised and very fortunate, to find that I did not have to do major revisions or rewrites for them, because I know, you know, that's often just part of what you have to do as an author.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah. Well, the book is out now. So yay.
Yay. Throw confetti.
Throw those hands up and we'll have party. But if we have a party, it's got to be like good old school dancing like they did in your book.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep.
Also, what is with the olives with cheese in it?
It sounded delicious. Does that not sound delicious to you?
It does.
Okay.
Where do they do this? I want it.
You know, I know I've seen them before. There's actually this, this cocktail bar I really liked when I lived in Houston, and one of their drinks was something called the Dirty Texan. And it was basically a martini made with mezcal. And there were these cheese stuffed olives in the glass. And it's a fantastic beverage. But yeah, I guess just for the, you know, for the party scene, it's tempting to think like, oh, this was a grand party and everything was wonderful and fantastic. But you only really bring that out when you actually get down to the details and say, well, what were they eating and drinking? What makes it so grand and fantastic? And I don't know what goes beyond cheese stuffed olives, but they were definitely having some of those.
Honestly, that sounds better than what's normally at parties, which is like cucumber sandwiches and like that weird, creepy, slimy water where they put cucumbers in it.
I like cucumber water.
It's
refreshing.
That's not water. That's some sort of alien goo.
Beverage?
At least just put a lemon in it or something.
Lemons make more sense than cucumbers to me, but...
Every time I've had cucumber water, it's always just like slimy. It's like really weird.
Maybe it's cool and crisp.
Maybe they weren't the cucumbers. I don't know.
I don't know. But hey, you can like it. It's free country, as we keep saying.
Did we go.
Did we want to ask Carrie about Cities and Thrones?
Yes, because you've got another book.
I do.
At some point in the future. You want to maybe mention a little bit about that?
So Cities and Thrones is the sequel to The Buried Life. It picks up almost immediately where The Buried Life ends. And Angry Robot has the manuscript right now. They're going to get back to me with edits in the next couple of weeks. And so we're hoping to have that out this summer, which is a fantastically, you know, short turnaround. But I would love to get Cities and Thrones out to readers, you know, so that by the time they finish The Buried Life, they've got the next one to move on to.
That's actually really quick, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, especially given the end to The Buried Life. That would be spoilery, ladies and gentlemen. I mentioned that. I could see how, yes, you want to know what happens next now that X and Y and Z have happened.
Exactly.
Kind of some big stuff. It involves dinosaurs and asteroids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah, they come down, and it's like Godzilla falls out of the asteroid, and it's sort of like Mothra shows up, but then these dinosaurs show up, and so Mothra and Godzilla have to team up. And in the middle of it is this city that's underground, and they're like, what up?
I'm going to put all of that in book three now.
He better be in the acknowledgments if you do.
Oh, absolutely.
Alrighty. We're not sure yet, but hopefully in summer we'll get the next book.
That's what things are looking like right now.
Awesome. Anything else that you want to mention that maybe folks can look forward to in the near future? I mean, convention appearances, if that's relevant, or if you're working on any other kind of fiction-related stuff. Or you did mention that you've got that video game you might want to plug.
Yes. Yeah. So Pillars of Eternity is an old-school isometric RPG in the tradition of games like Baldur's Gate, Icewind Dale, and Planescape Torment. That will be out on March 26th. On Mac, PC, and Linux. So look forward to that for sure. And then as far as conventions and appearances go, I will be at Comic Palooza in Houston over Memorial Day weekend. I will be at Convergence in Minneapolis over the 4th of July weekend.
Yay! We'll be there too.
Awesome.
It's my home con.
Mm-hmm. Last year was my first time to go, and it was fantastic. So I'm looking forward to it.
You were on a panel with us.
I was. It was delightful.
And listeners can listen to that on our feed.
Yes. Yeah.
I had a lot of fun. And then I'll be at World Fantasy and Worldcon in Spokane. So that's what this year's looking like for me.
Awesome. So you got a pretty busy year.
Yeah.
I hope so. And I hope to get to see you guys at Convergence and hopefully a few others of those.
Definitely Convergence. If I win the lotto, I will be at every con.
Awesome.
Because I will just quit my job and I will move to the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And just
but not Montana.
Montana's mountains. No offense, Montana, but I need like an international airport nearby.
Silly. Well,
it's true. Montana doesn't have an international airport. Does it?
I'd have to Google that. Maybe.
I get a one-way flight from anywhere in Montana without stops straight to London?
Probably not.
Okay. No. I'm sorry, Montana. No good. It's no dice.
Right. Anyway, that notwithstanding, thank you very much, Gary, for coming on our show for the first time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, technically second time if we count Convergence last year. Sean.
That's right. That's right. It is technically your second time, but it's your first time as an interviewee.
There we go.
There we go.
So, and do keep in touch for when the next book comes out.
Absolutely.
Perfect. And obviously, thanks, Paul, for being my co-host this round.
Oh, absolutely. Let's see. I've reviewed her book. I interviewed her for SF Signal. And now here, I'm kind of in Carrie's grill in a way. It's kind of weird. Hopefully,
it's been wonderful.
Hopefully not creepy.
No. I thank you guys so much. It's been great to be here and to chat with you guys today.
Excellent. So on that note, everybody, awkward ending and scene.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
In your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you, always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo, signing off.